Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday was UNESCO's World Press Freedom Day, and in its annual report on press freedom, the Committee to Protect Journalists said that worldwide, journalists held the line on press freedom for the first time in 8 years. In Tunisia, Interim President Moncef Marzouki marked World Press Freedom Day with a press conference in which he stressed the importance of free and independent media in the country, where the uprisings that became known as the Arab Spring had their beginnings. But on the same day, a court in Tunis found Nabil Karoui, owner of Nesma TV, guilty of harming public order and morality because of a broadcast of the film Persepolis. Our guest, Rhys Erlich, was in Tunisia in March and April and is making a brief stopover in the Bay Area before he flies to Libya tomorrow to cover the upcoming elections there. Rhys is a veteran freelance investigative journalist. His reporting has appeared in various outlets, including NPR, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Christian Science Monitor. Rhys, great to have you back on Your
Thanks.
Call.
Thanks. Good morning. It's more than a stopover. I do live in Oakland.
Yes, but, I know. Well,
but it's true. I'm off again tomorrow.
Taking a breather here. We appreciate you coming in, and we're glad we caught you. And I should also say that when Freedom House, another organization that released some rankings about press freedom, came out with its report yesterday, they said that the United States ranked number 22, tied with Estonia and Jamaica, and down a bit in part because of the treatment of journalists covering Occupy demonstrations last fall. Now, this week, Occupy activists, as well as organized labor and immigrant rights advocates, were out in force on May Day in the Bay Area. Curious to hear from listeners what you thought of coverage in the local media, what you think the coverage should look like, and how activists might actually try to change the kind of media that is out there about what they're doing. Meanwhile, also here in the Bay Area, Facebook made another important step toward its much-hyped public stock offering yesterday. Now, Facebook isn't in the news business per se, but millions of people get news through what they see on their Facebook pages or Twitter accounts, and that's changing how news is consumed and how it's made. That impact is the subject of Roy O'Connor's new book, Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. Rory is a reporter and filmmaker, and he's been managing editor and columnist at the media watchdog site MediaChannel.org for a decade, as well as the founding editorial director of the social news network NewsTrust.net. And he has a blog. Media is a plural. All of this at yourcallradio.org if you want to check his work out, or Rhys's work for that matter. And Rory, glad to have you with us here.
Thank you.
And listeners are welcome to join in the conversation. Was there reporting this week that impressed you, that depressed you, made you want to know more? And for you, has social media, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or something else, changed the way you get your news? And with the exploding number of online news sources, how do you decide who to trust? The number to call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or post comments at our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's start, as we always do, by focusing on some journalism that was done well this week. Rhys, you've been on the roundtable before. Why don't you jump in and start with
your
positivity?
I wanted to mention two. The first, I toot my own horn with an article I did for Global Post about the economic conditions in Tunisia. I visited Sidi Bouzid, where the uprising began that overthrew the government there and ultimately led to the other Arab Spring uprisings. But the uprising is not over in Tunisia. There's high unemployment, serious problems with inflation, and the current Islamist government is having its share of problems. So people might want to check that out. But the main article I wanted to focus on was your listeners may be aware that the government of Pakistan has cut off supplies to NATO and U.S. troops in Afghanistan. And it's been going on for 7 months. And when's the last time you actually saw an article about it? And I found an article in the Express Tribune by Huma Imtiaz. The Express Tribune apparently is affiliated with the International Herald Tribune. And for the first time in a long time that I can find, they report on this and that the serious impact that it's having on the U.S. war effort. But it's based on a Department of Defense report. It's not based on firsthand reporting because it's very difficult to get into that area. And it's also an issue that Pakistanis are not trying to publicize. And in the U.S., it's a big embarrassment. I mean, the main source of U.S. supplies into Afghanistan has been cut off for 7 months. And they try to put a positive spin on it that it's not as bad as it could be. But you know, billions of dollars worth of supplies are not making it in, and it's having an impact on the war effort.
Well, especially with the anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden, President Obama traveling to Afghanistan, clearly making some political points in doing that while also signing an agreement with the Afghan government. This is an opportune time to kind of say, oh, what's going on in Pakistan, yeah. Afghanistan?
Yeah, it's a classic example of why the mainstream media does or doesn't cover certain issues. The Pakistanis are not making an issue out of it. The Republicans are not making an issue out of it. It's a big embarrassment to the Obama administration. Therefore, it doesn't exist.
And I'd be interested in hearing from listeners about, I mean, one of the things that came out yesterday was this kind of small group of documents that came from the bin Laden compound that's gotten a lot of attention, even though it's really just a sliver of those documents, 6,000 documents that were found there, 17 of them released yesterday. Interesting, kind of think about how you pick and choose. You all have done editorial work, so it's certainly the...
It was interesting to note there, by the way, that Osama bin Laden felt that Fox News was not objective.
Well, this needs to be reported. Rory, do you want to jump in with your story this week that you thought was well covered, you want to draw attention to?
Yes, I do. You know, you mentioned the issue of who can we trust, and obviously, you know, trust in the mainstream legacy media, as measured by the Gallup polls, has been diminishing over the last 40 years to the point where, you know, one out of four Americans only now trust that the news media are bringing them reliable information. But I think it's important to note that this lack of trust can also extend to some of the new media brands. So there was a very interesting article in the New York Times by Kevin O'Brien just a couple of days ago looking at Google's activities with their so-called Street View mapping technology. And as we learned in the article, and we learned from previous articles by O'Brien, Google was flying over our houses and capturing wireless information that they shouldn't have, including people's passwords, entire emails, intimate details of their personal lives, unbeknownst to them. And what O'Brien, and also there's a federal investigation and European investigations of this, what he reported is that Google first said that it hadn't happened. They next said, oh, it did happen, but it was a mistake. They then revealed that, in fact, there had been a whole plan submitted to them to do it, but they said it was submitted by a rogue engineer, a single person operating on his own without their oversight. Upon further investigation, it turned out that that was not true either. So, you know, how much can we trust Google? How much can we trust Facebook, for example, which is also obviously in the news these days, very much at issue?
And I think,
Google? Right. It's like everyone had these high expectations because it seemed like it was some kind of a different company. It's not.
Well, and as you say, you know, this is a company whose unofficial but avowed motto is "Don't be evil." And I just want to mention as well, I have a piece that is just going up today on AlJazeera.net. on that very topic, and saying, you know, Google, whose motto is "Don't be evil," is being accused now of just that.
Well, I want to get back to that question of, you have Google, Facebook. These aren't news-producing organizations, but they're conduits through which news flows. I think the question of trust of those conduits and trust of the sources is something we definitely want to talk about more in the show, and is the subject largely of Roy O'Connor's book, Friends, Followers, and the Future. I wanted to come back to you, Reese Ehrlich, to talk about what you reported on in Tunis, what the kind of status of the people's movement there is, as you know, because I think, it's been remarkable seeing, you know, after the kind of anniversary of the uprisings, specifically in Tunisia and Egypt, after that, just the waning of coverage of what has happened in the Middle East, and really, you know, following what's going to happen to these democracies.
Yeah, the Tunisians complained about that as well. And I said, well, why don't you kind of gin up a local terrorist movement, and you'll get a lot more attention, and a lot more American funds will flow your way. Tunisia is probably the most stable of all the countries that have gone through uprisings. They are engaged in reasonably fair elections. There's a civil society that's emerging, a relatively freer press, ability to organize trade unions, for example, or organize political parties. But by no means is the struggle over. The old crony capitalist system is still in power, and that means they have a tremendous influence over the elections. Sorry. And there is tremendous discontent economically. As I mentioned earlier, 19% unemployment, growing inflation, and the current government, which is led by a kind of a center-right Islamist party called Ennahda, has about a year before the next elections. And if they don't turn the economy around, we're going to see pretty widespread discontent and possibly them voted out.
Is economic issues and issues of corruption, people feeling powerless in dealing with government, that was really at the root of what...
It was, and it's still a key issue. I visited Sidi Bouzid, where the uprising began, and the day I arrived, there was a demonstration in front of the city hall, right at the same spot where Mohamed Bouzizi had immolated himself that began the uprising. So the economic issues are important. What's really interesting, and this will sound familiar to American listeners, the Islamists, particularly the more extremist Islamists, want to divert the discussion from the economy to social issues. So is this movie an insult to Islam? Did so-and-so...
Persepolis.
There was a side nude photo published in a newspaper, and that was an insult to Islam. It's just like the conservatives in this country who say, well, it's not jobs, it's abortion rights, or it's gay rights, or something like that. And suddenly the discussion is off in a whole other direction. And the same thing is happening in Tunisia and more broadly in the Arab world.
And so, how do you look, when you, as someone outside coming in and looking at that, I mean, obviously, I think that kind of Islamist, secularist divide, that's a very common lens for the international media to understand Tunisia or most other Arab countries. Yeah.
It's there. It is an issue. But the core issue is the economy. And what feeds all, even the Islamist groups who have a popular base, are providing social services through the mosques or through their charitable organizations, because that's their response to the economic crisis. The reason it doesn't get as much coverage, I'm not saying it's none, but it doesn't get the coverage it deserves, is because these countries are following the neoliberal policies supported by the U.S. So if they're failing, it's kind of embarrassment. I mean, you don't look as critically at these crony capitalist places if they're part of the IMF, if they're accepting World Bank loans. The U.S. gave $100 million to Tunisia to help its economy, but it wasn't money that the government could then use to provide jobs, for example. It was to pay down their debt to the IMF. So it went from one account in Washington to another account in Washington without ever having to go dirty its hands in Tunisia itself. But that's considered a big, some kind of a big sign of solidarity by the U.S. government. And that the neoliberal policies carried out by these governments are really at the core of the problems.
So I'm interested, I want to bring Rory back in as well, because you talk about the role of social media, both in how it's transforming journalism, but also it has a huge impact on social movements. And certainly the Arab Spring is one of the places people said, oh, you know, Twitter had this impact in Egypt that some things that could have, that were done by people in those movements that wouldn't have been able to be done otherwise. I'm just interested in your observations about that, Rory, having done the work you have on this new book, and then to come back to you, Rhys, to hear kind of what's it doing now when it's not trending on Twitter.
Well, precisely, and as I'm sure you both know, there's a bit of a controversy over the impact of Twitter and Facebook in the Arab Spring movements. They're set up again, just as with the Islamist and secularist, and two camps, the so-called cyber realists, who say that Twitter and Facebook had nothing to do with it, and the cyber utopians who say that they were Twitter revolutions. And of course, as usual, the actual truth of the situation is far more nuanced. And when you go down and you look at it, you see that both are true. And one of the things that I did was, silly me, a little reporting. I decided, well, instead of just opining, like, let's say, Malcolm Gladwell did in his renowned piece in The New Yorker, where he said these Twitter revolutions were a farce, I went and talked to a lot of the Arab, Egyptian, in this case, activists, who are the young people, largely, who had been very involved in the creation. And what they told me was, no, these are not Twitter revolutions. Of course not. They reflect the revolutions that overturned the authoritarian regime in Egypt were literally decades in the making. They described to me how it went back to their parents' generation in 1972. That being said, of course, nothing like the revolution had happened for many, many years, and they said it was greatly facilitated by this new media that enabled them for the first time to really amplify their voices, create these instant networks, if you will. And one of the activists put it, and that's how I end my chapter in the book about the Arab Spring. I think he put it better than I can. And I quote, "The internet has helped revolution, but the internet is not revolution.
All right. And
yeah, I think that's accurate. In 1979, the people of Iran rose up against the Shah, and it was called, believe it or not, a cassette revolution. Why? Because Ayatollah Khomeini had sent cassettes, tape cassettes of his speeches, and they were widely circulated and reproduced, and that was the amazing technology of the day. Today, does anyone remember 1979 as the cassette revolution? Not unless you're Iranian or were part of it at the time. That's just dropped out. So the idea that actually a lot of the Egyptian activists I spoke to when I was there were insulted by the idea of the Twitter revolution because, for exactly the reasons that Rory stated, it was a genuine revolution based on economic and political issues, of which not so much Twitter, but Facebook could play a role as a communications tool. They actually use their cell phones and text messaging much more than they did the other tools. But, you know, as long as that perspective is kept in mind. And they also pointed, I said, well, why do you think the popularity in the Western media for the use of the term Twitter revolution? And they said, because Twitter is an American invention. Americans love to see things in their own image. And it also helps take away from some of the more radical demands that were being put forward by the people in the street.
This is Reese Ehrlich, who is an independent journalist, award-winning reporter, who has been going back and forth between the Middle East and here in the Bay Area, where he makes his home. He was in Tunisia this past month. He'll be heading to Libya tomorrow. And also with us is Rory O'Connor. He is the author of Friends, Followers, and the Future. You can learn more about their reporting at yourcallradio.org, where you can also leave comments. I also invite you to call in, join the Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on this Friday. Rose will be back on Monday. The number to call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I'm bringing this discussion about social media, social movements, and news media together. I also invite folks to call in and talk about protests connected to Occupy, immigrant rights, labor unions this week, how those were covered, and how those movements are using social media and how that changes their relationship to the mainstream media. The number to call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to come back to you, Rory. I know you probably want to follow up on what Reese had to say, but you're talking about the cyber realists versus the cyber utopians. And having at least given a good look at your book and read some of what you have to say, it seems to me, when it comes to journalism, you're on the cyber-utopian side, relatively.
Well, I'm on the positive side, is how I would put it, because I don't see things in... it's useful to put things in those two extremes, frankly. But I do think that we're, as I say in the book, that we're really in the beginning, and this is not too strong a term, of a true revolution. And the revolution is not just the political revolutions that we've seen in the Arab Spring. It's not just the political revolts that we see in the Occupy movement here. It's actually a much larger digital information revolution that is rapidly and radically transforming the ways we live, we work, we play, we do politics, and most importantly, how we communicate with one another.
Well, so it's a radical transformation. It's a time of great uncertainty. But what's the argument for why it's generally a positive one? I mean, that seems to me the argument you make in your book, and certainly there's a thing about lowering barriers, more people can do it. But does it mean actually people get better news?
Well, that's an important question, but let me just back up and answer the first part of your question, which is why do I think it's a revolution? Because the entire media system of the previous century has now been overturned and stood on its head. That was a system, as we can recall, that was highly centralized, highly hierarchical, and the only people really who were allowed, if you will, who had the means to do journalism was a professional priesthood of trained journalists. And now we have a media system that's rapidly evolving, but it's non-hierarchical, participatory, and far more democratic, because for the first time in history, you know, literally billions of people have the means to make their own news, and more importantly, the means to distribute that and other news to billions of people, you know, literally at the speed of light. And as I said, we are in a revolution. It's very messy. It's chaotic. We're only in the beginning of it. You know, how this will turn out actually depends on how we, the citizens, now respond to these new tools and technologies and, you know, what values we put forth.
And how do you see, how is it changing? Just give us some real specific senses of how, even for the people who are still in the priesthood, how this is changing the way reporting is happening?
Well, what it has done is it has made everyone potentially a journalist. And, you know, for example, I have a chapter on Twitter, and the chapter is called News No Longer Breaks, It Tweets. And I use the anecdote of when an airplane in 2009 crashed into the Hudson River with 150 people on it. Now, this plane literally went down opposite the worldwide headquarters of the Associated Press, the New York Times, and the three major broadcast networks. But yet, how did we first find out about that news? From an ordinary citizen named Janice Crumbs, who happened to be on a ferry taking a tourist trip when the plane landed almost opposite him. He immediately snapped a picture on his iPhone, tweeted, "A plane is down in the Hudson. We don't know if anyone is hurt. We're going over to help," and put a picture out. And instantly, this picture, you know, went around the world. So here's an ordinary person who scooped the world through Twitter. So the speed, for example, of news, there's always been a tension, as you know, between speed and accuracy. Speed has now devolved so that anyone can practice journalists, whether they're a trained journalist or not. So that's one of the major shifts.
And I want to hear from Reese, your experience in Tunisia, Syria, Libya, where you're headed tomorrow. How is some of that change playing out there? Are there more people being able to participate as journalists?
Well, yes. There's certainly more people who are sending out messages on Facebook, Twitter, various other internet forums. I guess I'm maybe one of these old-fashioned kind of guys that I still make a distinction between sources with cell phones and journalists. That is, what you described was very important, but that person was not in a situation, for example, to assess how many people were injured, why did the plane go down, what was the circumstances that led up to it. Those were things that the journalists had to do. Now, I don't think to be a journalist you have to work for the New York Times or have a journalism degree. There's lots of ways to learn journalism, but there is a skill to being a journalist, multiple sources, checking your facts, providing background that people who have not been through that process don't have. So there's still a distinction to be made between people who are providing sourced information on the spot and journalism.
Well, I agree there's still a distinction, but I think that distinction is rapidly going away. And, you know, in my chapter on the Arab Spring and the international movement, one of the people I look at is a fellow named Andy Carvin, who is not a journalist, who is actually a social media strategist for NPR. Now, Andy was an early blogger, and so he had ties with bloggers in Tunisia from having gone there to a conference in 2005. So when the events, you know, began in December of 2010 in Sidi Bouazid, Carvin got contacted by some of those bloggers, and they said, "Look, can you help us out a little bit?"
Well, we're going to hear more about Andy Carvin and get a little more into this debate about who is a journalist, how is that changing. We're going to be taking a break here in a moment. I'm Matt Martin, and I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar on the Your Call Media Roundtable today. My guest, Rory O'Connor, who you're just hearing, his new book is Friends, Followers, and the Future, about the impact of social media on the news industry, on reporting, on how we take in news and information. Also with me, award-winning independent journalist Reese Ehrlich. You can find both of their reports at yourcallradio.org. That is also where you can leave comments and questions for this discussion, and where you can get in dialogue with other people who are in the listening audience. And we also welcome your calls at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Does having real journalists, whatever that means, still matter to you? And how do you define what it means to be a journalist when it comes to deciding how you trust the news reports that you're finding on the internet? Or do you depend on certain portals for your news, certain people you say, okay, well, those are folks who are the right kind of gatekeepers? Or are you voracious? You're going all over and trying to make judgments for yourself. 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco. Do you love public radio and This American Life? Well, you can combine your passions by going to KALW.org and making a contribution to KALW today. Because right now we have a limited number of passes for a special This American Life cinema event. that's happening on this coming Thursday, May 10th at 8 p.m. at theaters in San Francisco, Palo Alto, and San Mateo. All the details are at kalw.org. And thanks for listening to and supporting your local public radio station.
This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our email newsletter to keep up with what's coming up. On Monday, we'll be talking about the economic impact of student debt, which has reached more than $1 trillion. That's more than the amount owed on credit cards. Quite remarkable and certainly worth paying attention to. And on Tuesday, we're going to be talking to Steve Call. He's the author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. If you have a show idea for us, you can always drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we also welcome your calls today. I'm here with Reese Ehrlich and Rory O'Connor. We're talking about coverage of the Arab Spring, now almost a year and a half after its beginning, talking about social media and newsmaking and news consumption. And also, one of the subjects I brought up earlier was coverage of May Day demonstrations here in the Bay Area, around the country. One of those examples where, you know, you have a moment to really talk about how is a movement being covered in the media. If you are someone who either was at one of those demonstrations, whether it was labor, immigrant rights, or one of the Occupy demonstrations, and then you saw how it was covered in the news media, give us your observations at 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Reese, we were talking while we were off the air, and you had some observations.
Yeah, I watched the news coverage very closely on May Day, and I have to say, Channel 2 News, which I used to have some respect for back a number of years back, it was just awful coverage. It was live coverage out of Oakland. It was 6 minutes into the show, a solid 6 minutes before they ever mentioned why people were protesting. It was all about they attacked this, there was vandalism here, paint were thrown at the police, police response was so-and-so. And it unfortunately, too much of the coverage of the Occupy movement has to do with sensationalizing the question of violence. Did it happen? Didn't it happen? Reaction of the business community. And either downplaying or ignoring the demands that why are people out there in the first place? And, one thing you might look at, imagine if the coverage of Syria was like that. What if the first 500 words of the story was about violence by the protesters against the Syrian government, and there was no mention of why they were protesting? Well, people would be outraged at that. Well, why is it okay when you do it, when you apply that same criteria to Occupy movement?
Roy O'Connor, I know you were actually out in Frank Ogawa Plaza in Oakland on May Day.
I was, and I think it's no wonder that the Gallup polls, for example, show that only one of four Americans now trusts the accuracy of the news and information that he or she receives. And also, in terms of the Occupy movement, let's not forget that when it started last fall, at least in New York City, and I live in New York City, so when Zuccotti Park was occupied really by a small number of people initially, and it began to grow very rapidly, the initial response from the mainstream media, particularly the New York Times, was first to ignore it and then to scoff at it and to minimize it. And it was only when the Occupy people began using these new media tools and technologies that I write about in my book, on their own to create their own media and their own narrative, that the mainstream media was actually forced to change and greatly, in my opinion, greatly improve their coverage.
Well, but those tools haven't gone away, but the coverage clearly, like the point, there was kind of clearly a kind of turning point last fall when coverage of Occupy Wall Street and its issues, the 99% as a phrase, Occupy, whatever it is, became, you heard it everywhere. There was some turn that happened there. Those tools are still around. What changes as time goes on?
What changed was that there was pushback, not only from big media, but from big politics. In New York City, for example, the New York Police Department responded in some incredibly aggressive ways against citizens, and also, as you mentioned earlier, World Press Freedom Day, against the journalists themselves. So we saw that whether it's the new media or the legacy media, if you're in the United States and you begin reporting the truth, you're going to get some serious pushback, and you might even get hit over the head by a police baton.
But, Reese, just to be kind of contrarian about it, movements, social movements, protesters, we've seen this cycle thousands of times. Anyone who's gone out into the streets and then goes and watches 10 o'clock news tends to see a contrast between what they understood and what then they see on the in that coverage. It can be better or it can be worse. It seems like knowing that, there are strategies for trying to affect that coverage. And I just wonder what you all think about, kind of at this point in this movement, what you'd be saying. Here's what I'd be thinking about. You know, if you all know how stories get pitched, how they get slanted, what happens in editorial meetings. You know, what should people who are involved in a movement be thinking about when they're thinking about that relationship to the media?
Well, the mainstream media tend to see things in terms of good guys and bad guys. And that's true whether it's coverage of Syria or Oakland.
In Syria or Egypt, there was a clear target of a bad guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Chronicle ran a story maybe about a week ago purporting to show the divisions within the Occupy movement. You had the violent anarchist evils, and then you had the good, nonviolent, kind of more mainstreamy type people. And as usual, there was some truth in that. There are people who are more likely to engage in violent actions than others, but there's a lot more overlap and it's a lot more nuanced than that article portrayed. And so I think for activists who want to have a wider impact, it's important not to fall into that good guy, bad guy dichotomy, and to understand that the media is going to, it may be favorable to you one day and then it's going to turn on you the next, and that you have to have your alternative means through the social media, through a variety. You know, this is not something brand new. The technology is new, but in the 60s, in the anti-Vietnam War movement, there was something called Liberation News Service. It was an alternative wire service that went out to underground papers and alternative papers to put out an alternative view. There's indie media now. There's a host of websites, and then when the pressure builds up, the media will start to shift its coverage as well.
And, you know, look, I agree with Reese that there is a bias in the mainstream media, but in my opinion, it's not the bias that most people see, whether on the right they see it be left, vice versa. The real bias is that of commerce. They're trying to sell. And what sells, exactly what Reese said, was conflict. So what we're looking at, the mainstream media that is basically motivated by private profit, not by public service. So if you're out there in the Occupy movement, you're quite obviously not sharing that same motivation. So my message, and they don't need to hear it from me because they already incorporated it, but the message is, and to quote the great from the Bay Area, Scoop Nisker, if you don't like the news, go ahead and make some of your own.
Yeah, that's certainly something we believe here on your call. We got an email in, just kind of changing the subject, from a listener who asked, Reese wants to specifically direct a question to you. He says, what can Reese and your other guests say about many leftist claims that the entire Libyan uprising was orchestrated by Western imperialist powers, especially the U.S., Britain, and other Western European countries, in order to take over Libya's oil, set up bases, install a pro-U.S. regime, etc., and especially talking about AFRICOM, the U.S. strategic plan on the continent of Africa. Any observation you got for there? And also just give us a little preview of what you're hoping to work on when you head to Libya tomorrow.
I'm glad you asked. The uprisings in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Syria are genuine grassroots movement similar to the Occupy movement here. Sometimes they're leaderless. Sometimes Islamist forces of various stripes have a stronger impact than in others. It depends on country to country. What happened was, in the case of Libya, the Western Europeans and the U.S. saw an opportunity to use the uprising for their own purposes. That doesn't mean they instigated it or that they created it. There's absolutely no indication or proof that that's the case. One of the reasons that Libya is in such chaos today is precisely because of the foreign intervention and the fact that the U.S. doesn't come in to protect human rights. It comes in to make sure that the oil flows, make sure that Libya is a stable pro-Western country in a volatile region. And so you have to find rebels that agree with you. They can't simply be for democracy. They have to be for the U.S. version of democracy. And that's then that leads to instability. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. Oil production is almost back up to what it was under Gaddafi.
Well, but
the country's in chaos.
Well, I mean, obviously this parallels the conversation that went on around Iraq when the invasion happened there and talking about U.S. oil companies wanting to get a stake there. It doesn't seem that U.S. oil companies are actually going to end up controlling what happens in Libya.
No,
what does it mean
Western,
to control the oil?
Well, okay, first of all, one of the reasons the U.S. was reluctant to get involved, if you remember the debate about whether it's in our national interest, is because U.S. oil companies don't have a huge controlling interest in Libya specifically. They do in other parts of the Middle East, but not in Libya. Their main, Libya's main oil exports goes first to Italy and then to France. And France, as you recall, Sarkozy was a big promoter of military intervention in Libya. So oil, I don't think it's like the White House sits around and says, what can we do to get more profits for oil companies today? I think they say, look at Libya as a strategic question. Tunisia is in uprising. Egypt's in uprising. If we don't, the people of Libya are in uprising. Here's our chance to insert a pro-U.S. government there, which, by the way, will have policies favorable to U.S. and Western European oil companies, and in the long run will help provide oil. I think that's the way they look at it. It's a military, political, economic question in all of these issues. And what doesn't enter into it is the people of Libya themselves and what the consequences of this military intervention is going to be for them. And I think as long as it's not too chaotic, the U.S. is going to live with what's going on here. But none of that means that the U.S. had instigated or that it wasn't a genuine popular uprising when it began.
I'm going to invite listeners, if they want to call in, whether it's about the Occupy and other demonstrations this week on May Day, coverage of the Arab Spring, other issues, Obama going to Afghanistan, making the speech there on the anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. But since Libya, I think about how much coverage there was when, in those final weeks when, it's the question of, when there was the battle for control. And then, of course, once Gaddafi's gone, so is this subject. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you can just talk a little bit. What's your agenda going to Libya? What are you hoping to report on? And bring us up to date, because most people, they've lost consciousness of Libya and where it is politically.
I'm going to be reporting about the oil and the fact, why is it that oil production is almost back up to what it was before, but the country remains in chaos. I'll be looking at the secessionist or the movement for greater federalism in the eastern part of the country, in Benghazi area. I'll be looking at, is this the success that is purported in the West? In other words, if you talk to people at the U.S. State Department, they think Libya was a great success for foreign intervention, so-called humanitarian intervention. I have my doubts. But I'm going to go with an open mind in terms of who I'm going to talk to, and I'll hopefully come back and talk about it on the show.
I want to read a comment that came in from a listener who says, in light of the recent Rupert Murdoch scandal, Fox News, the infotainment model of most mainstream news media corporations, etc., I welcome citizen journalism to provide some counterpoint to the constant spin bombardment. He says, recall manufacturing consent by Noam Chomsky, which at this point is over 30 years old. Rory, do you want to jump in?
Well, I'm glad to hear that the listeners agree with us, and all I would say to them again is, go out there and do it yourself. It is true, that in a sense this is not new. Over time there was the cassette revolution. Let's not forget, what happened in Tiananmen Square when the fax was the new technology that people were saying was creating a revolution. So these are just tools, and tools, as we know, can be used for good or ill. You can take a hammer and you can build a house, or you can hit somebody over the head with it. So we're in a situation right now, as I said, I don't think it's too much to say that we are in a digital information revolution. The outcome is unclear, and it's really dependent on we, the people. Exactly that same frame of political, military, economic that Reese was describing in Libya is the same frame that's being applied here in the United States to Occupy. And once again, what's being left out of that equation? The people themselves.
But an important frame for people who want to use that media is this corporate frame of Facebook, Twitter, Google. Talk about what that supposedly neutral frame has to do with what can be, these are the tools available to people. If someone in Tunisia wants to reach people in the United States, that's the way they do it. What do you see as the potentially, what are you concerned about in that corporate frame for that kind of popular media.
Well, what I'm concerned about is that it is a corporate frame, exactly what you're saying.
But how could that affect content? I think most people can't connect those two things very well.
Well, look, the whole issue of trust is the central one underlying my book. Not only how can we find trustworthy news and information, because that's important to have a functioning democracy, but, you know, which, if any, of these either legacy media corporations or, in fact, the new media corporations are worthy of our trust. And, you know, if they're not, then we're going to have to find ways to circumvent them. So, you know, Facebook, Google, very, very powerful, obviously. But one of the messages in my book is that if they continue to not be trustworthy, violating our privacy, acting in literally in antitrust ways, because they're under investigation for that, they have the possibility of losing our trust. And since they themselves are really only tools and technology brands, if you will, if someone came along and created a better mousetrap, a better Facebook, one that was not violating our trust, one that was not taking our private information and selling it, maybe one that was taking our private information with our consent, selling it, and sharing some of the revenue with us, you know, I think 900 million people might very rapidly leave Facebook and go there.
Well, I think there's some efforts along that line going on. I know I've heard some reported recently.
Yeah, let's not forget that most people, or many, many people, use Facebook as a strictly, you know, they send you, what did they have for lunch? Or I got a photo of a boa constrictor eating a deer. I mean, well, you know, you get all kinds of weird...
That's true, but let's also not forget that Facebook is now the leading driver of traffic to news sites all over the world, far surpassing, for example, Google search technology.
Well, for better or worse, let's go to Margaret in San Francisco, who has called into the Media Roundtable. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you very much. I'm finding this very interesting. I don't find self-aggrandizing bloggers necessarily trustworthy. They encourage individuals to seek out perspectives that confirm to already strongly held biases. I'm not suggesting that print is unbiased, but just flipping through the pages of newspapers can offer slightly more perspective. And along these lines, to my knowledge, your call ignores most questions about the outcomes of the occupiers' actions, and especially in Oakland. I'll take my answer off the air.
Margaret, thanks for the call. No, it's definitely, I mean, it's certainly true that, I mean, people are very concerned about, I mean, the stories of property destruction, clashes with police. There's a reason why people pay attention to those stories. They, especially if you're living in the cities where they're happening or in the neighborhoods where they're happening, it has a real, real impact in your life. So I'm glad that you brought that forward. But also, I'd just like to kind of get your response, Rory and Reese, about the kind of question of, yeah, anyone who claims there's a blogger who does a post every day and, you know, claims to have some kind of authority about things. I mean, it's remarkable. You know, something like Huffington Post, where it's very broad. Who can be on there and what actually gets something ranked on the front of something like Huffington Post? People can get a stature that they would have previously only have gotten to with a lot more effort. So I'm just curious about your observations.
Well, you know, my response to that is that I think we now live, for the first time in history, in a situation where most of us, almost everybody on the planet, has access potentially to more diverse news and information than any time in history. So I agree with the caller that, you know, so-called self-aggrandizing bloggers are perhaps not the best news site, but my message to her would be to broaden her menu of news choices. Read more bloggers. Read, you know, bloggers that perhaps she doesn't agree with, as well as ones that she does agree with, and also broaden it out and read more than blogs, because there's a tremendous opportunity to get reliable news and information, but you have to work for it.
Yeah, and to the second part of her question, I think it is important. I've covered the Occupy movements, and it is important, you know, when in San Francisco, apparently a splinter group went off and smashed windows of small businesses. That has nothing to do with the 1%. The problem in the mainstream news coverage of that is that it's good guy merchants versus evil black-clad anarchists. And there's little nuance in the reporting. Who are the folks who are engaging this? How much popular support do they have, which is not much? So it's the coverage, I think it's reprehensible, some of these actions that have taken place, but it the reporting on it doesn't give you any sense of why, who these people are, why they're doing it, what the other folks in the Occupy movement stand for.
We got an email from Karen in Oakland who says, the Oakland Tribune did a really fair job of covering the May 1st marches and assemblies. They separated the Occupy demonstrators and their valid issues from the Black Bloc troublemakers clearly. Sorry, I've tossed that issue of the paper, so I can't credit the reporter. Well, Karen, thank you so much for doing that. I'm sure the Tribune appreciates that. And let's go to our next caller, who is Andy from Redwood City. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, my comment has to do with President Obama going to Afghanistan, which you mentioned. And it just bothers me, the disingenuousness of it, the ignominiousness of it, that we assassinated Osama bin Laden. We could have taken him prisoner. We could have had a trial. The model would have been like Adolf Otto Eichmann, the SS colonel, who was captured, I believe, in Argentina and brought over to Israel for trial. So you get everything laid out. You get all the facts, and you have a learning experience. Here, we're too cowardly. Instead, we assassinate people. And we don't talk about these assassinations. Where's the trial? Where's Nuremberg? Where's the learning experience?
Andy,
thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Much appreciated.
Yeah, I think your point is well taken. And the reason that is not part of the general discourse is because neither high-ranking Republicans nor high-ranking Democrats express that view. And therefore, it's excluded from the mainstream media. So if the only thing we hear from the Republicans is, oh, I would have done it too. I would have done it sooner. You know, all of the criticism of Obama is coming from the right, that he should be more militaristic, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the policies of the Obama administration on Afghanistan, Pakistan are as bad or worse than those of Bush.
You know, I'm really glad the caller brought this up. And, you know, talking about assassinations without any trial or due process, you know, let's not forget that President Obama is also the first president in U.S. history to assassinate U.S. citizen, a U.S. citizen, without any due process or trial.
And we are, but that was the voice of Rory O'Connor. Also with us here on the Media Roundtable is Reese Ehrlich. The number to call if you want to join us in the closing minutes of the program is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or you can call or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Reese, another thought?
Yeah, just another bone to pick about coverage of Afghanistan. Okay, the official line of the State Department and Defense Department is, we're winning the war in Afghanistan. And every time, like, the Taliban or the Haqqani network paralyzes the city of Kabul, they attack compounds where foreigners live or government institutions, that's a sign of their weakness. And those quotes are then quoted in the mainstream media. Seriously, you know, it's like a few more weakness attacks like this and the U.S. is going to be forced out of Afghanistan.
Actually, since we're running towards the end of time, we were talking a little bit earlier, Rory, about the relationship between people making news, making journalism within these kind of corporate frames of Facebook, Google, et cetera. And then in this past week, there was a bill passed by the House known as CISPA that has to do with online privacy. And I'd just be curious and tell us a little bit about what you know about that bill. Obviously, there was so much attention on SOPA, which was a previous kind of related, somewhat related issue. But this has not gotten as much attention, yet it really seems to allow for the real free sharing of information between these companies and the government.
Well,
without a warrant, without any kind of justification.
Precisely, and that's why it's even more dangerous than SOPA, if you will. And, you know, this is, again, sort of the modern equivalent of something that's been going on for many, many years. You know, the telecommunications companies, as we know, have long done exactly this. There was the famous case of the AT&T head end, I believe, right here in San Francisco, which was basically diverting all sorts of traffic directly to the government. So they're now trying to extend this into, you know, the new media companies, as you say, the Googles and the Facebook. I think it's something that we really need to start paying a lot more attention to and start organizing around.
And we've got information about that at yourcallradio.org. I want to get a last caller in, Paul in Boulder Creek. We are running short on time, so if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it. Welcome.
All right, thanks. I'm just curious about a few words of infiltration of the Occupy movement and how that might be part of violence that's fomented. And I'll take my answer off the air.
You know, yeah, I'm really glad he asked that because I was going to address that earlier. You know, one of the things we're seeing in this media revolution now is the decline of investigative reporting, because the legacy media used to do that supported by advertising, and that model's gone away. There are attempts to grapple with it, yes, but we're in a period now where we really don't have enough. And I think that's one of the things, if I had, you know, a grant for investigative reporting, that's the first thing that I would fund, is somebody go out there and investigate. And I won't say if, but I would say how many of the people in the Black Bloc, for example, are actually in the employ of the federal government.
So we're short on time, but how would you begin that investigation? I just want to know. I mean, it seems to me very obviously, authorities are never going to talk to you about that. People in a movement have their suspicions, have people they don't trust. How do you do that?
I would crowdsource it, as they say. I would put it out. I would start on Twitter, for example, and I would say, hey, I'm launching an investigation into this. Does anybody have any ideas? Does anybody have any leads? Here's how to contact me.
And then, yeah, absolutely. And then once you get some promising leads, you dig in it, you try and find that person, you try to find out, are they simply suspicious or they really are an agent? And there's ways to find out, because people's stories don't match up. I've actually in the past uncovered undercover agents, and they have false identities. They can't cover up. You find their license plates on their cars. There's various ways to track them down and figure out who they really are.
So I think just in essence, combine the new media with the values of the old media.
Well, here's hoping someone out there who wants to fund a reporting project is listening. You've been tuned into Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. With me as my guest and in this conversation have been Rory O'Connor. He is the author of the new book, Friends, Followers, and the Future. And you can find out more about that book and his other works at yourcallradio.org. Also with me is Reese Ehrlich. He's an independent journalist whose has reports carried on NPR, Christian Science Monitor, San Francisco Chronicle, many other places. He is headed back to Libya tomorrow. Reese will be following your reporting. And hopefully you can come back and visit us when you get back here in the Bay Area.
I would love to do that.
Thanks to everyone who called or emailed today. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and I'll be right back to tell you what we have in store for you on Monday. What does rising student debt mean for the future of our economy? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about student debt, which has surpassed $1 trillion, exceeding the total amount Americans are carrying on their credit cards. The average college graduate has more than $25,000 in student debt. With jobs hard to find, how are they coping? Join us live at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Share your story and talk about solutions. It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hi, I'm Tavis Smiley. Dr. Cornel West and I were so energized by last Saturday's KALW event at the Paramount, but we know so many of you couldn't get in because we were, well, over capacity. So this week on Smiley and West, we'll bring you some highlights from that conversation. And speaking of Oakland, Black Panther Party co-founder Bobby Seale joins us on the program as well. It's all later this afternoon at 1 p.m. right here on 91.7 FM KALW.
Stay tuned for that. And, of course, at 12 o'clock, it's the Tavis Smiley Show, then Smiley and West at 1 o'clock on your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco, on the web, kalw.org. Next up, we go to the BBC World Service out of London for World Have Your Say on KALW, San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern. Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say. Is Africa portrayed fairly in the media?
You guys inadvertently concentrate on the downside. Africans are poor, they are uneducated, they are uncivilized, they are barbaric. I think that has to change.
We're devoting all four editions of our radio and television shows today to how Africa is seen around the world. And so many of you have got in touch with very different views. Some of you say the coverage is biased and way too negative. And others say no, Africa has lots of problems that need to be reported by Western media. You can post now, facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Are the media reflecting reality? Or are there other stories that still need to be told? You can find us on Skype. We're BBC_WHYS.